Good afternoon, traders, and welcome back to the CFRN E-Mini Futures Cast. This is the daily broadcast of indeterminate length, where we discuss all things E-Mini, along with some really big ideas on the finer points of trading gold, bonds, crude, sugar, the euro, and even T-bills. Joining us today from our studios in Boston, Mr. Michael Bork. From our trading desk in Chicago, Mr. Burton Schlichter. And from our studios in Las Vegas, Nevada, Mr. David Williams. Now, to get things started, let's go to our host and founder in Studio A, overlooking South Mountain, America's largest city park. Here's Dwayne.
So let me scroll down through the list here, and let me find James. There he is. James, I'm going to open up your mic right now. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. James Katulis, we would like to welcome you to CFRN. We brought you on to a cheesy smattering of applause. How's that?
Great.
We're real high-tech here. James, thanks for taking a few minutes out of your busy schedule to come in and chat with us and talk about this issue. We are commodity traders, futures traders. You are a broker who... I've been reading a lot of articles about you. You're the broker who had... You went to law school...
Not a broker.
You went to law school... and became a hedge fund manager and had no plans to become an attorney, and yet here you are representing some 8,000 customers of MF Global.
Unfortunately.
Did I get that right?
Well, I mean, it's really more like 10,000 members of the coalition, but I've essentially been the de facto attorney for all customers, since there's really only one other group out there doing any kind of customer advocacy. And now it looks like we've got another 20 to 25,000 victims at PFG, unfortunately.
You know, I wasn't sure how I should address you, boy wonder of the MF Global nightmare, or the white,
go for something or, a little,
or the more or the white knight, or should I just call you James?
James is fine.
Okay, and this is your website, the Commodity Customer Coalition. This is where folks can go to learn more about you, your organization, what you're doing. Maybe you can just kind of bring us up to speed on who you are, how you got involved, and what's going to happen next.
I'm a rather young guy. I run a commodity trading fund here in Chicago. Last October, when MF Global went bankrupt in unprecedented fashion, essentially the futures industry froze like deer in the headlights, and no one really stepped up to protect customers from all the different parties who rushed into bankruptcy court to try to loot the bankruptcy estate, such as J.P. Morgan. I was in New York at the time of the bankruptcy. I filed was preparing to file an emergency motion on behalf of our customers who are at MF Global, and the New York Times kind of picked that up, and before I knew it, I had about 1,000 people a day calling our office. My poor little sister said she felt like a grief counselor for a good couple months and was hearing phones ringing her sleep. Wound up meeting a guy named John Rowe, who a broker here in Chicago, and whose father's a congressman from Tennessee, and the two of us teamed up and in response to just a void in the industry, we formed the CCC as a nonprofit advocacy group to represent everybody and do our best to get everybody's money back. In the MF Global case, we did a very good job of doing that. The trustee's initial plan was to distribute about 60% of clients' assets right about now, by, you know, really kind of using the media as our friend to embarrass a lot of the white shoe law firms and people who try to make bankruptcy processes take as long as possible. We were able to get customers 72% of their money back before Christmas of last year, and they're now up to 80%, at least those that were holding accounts in the U.S. due to differences in the laws in Britain. Unfortunately, those customers are not faring nearly as well, but it's something that's pretty much outside of our control. But now customers are able to sell their claims to distressed debt buyers at between about 93 to 96 cents on the dollar for U.S. accounts, based in large part on our advocacy work. So, you know, well, I'm certainly not happy that we get to relive this process for another group of poor customers 8 months after I'm a global. I'd like to think that at least the people at PFG are in good hands with us representing them.
Now, the difference between MF Global and PFG, correct me if I'm wrong, but one was a trade gone bad and the other was a man gone bad?
You know, in MF Global, that's kind of what's been put out there in the media, but I disagree. I think wholeheartedly fraud was committed at MF Global. It just was a sneakier, more disguised fraud. Our organization authored a brief describing seven badges of fraud that we believe are readily apparent at MF Global. The trustees' report on the matter, I feel, strengthens our brief, and we think it's an absolute travesty that the principals there are not in jail and that their assets have not been frozen. And you know, we'd urge the government to really step in and make some justice done. I mean, you know, here at PFG, one day after the uncovering of the fraud, you have assets frozen and the CFTC rushing to court. But MF Global, we're 8 months later. You know, the fraud is there, even though it's not as blatant as having a suicide note from the CEO. But it should be prosecuted as well.
What do you think the chances are that clients of PFG will see a return of their money?
Well, they're definitely going to get some of their money back. It's really hard to say how much at this point. There's a lot of analysis and discovery that needs to be done on the just what kind of assets are still there. From what I've heard from sources inside PFG, their early rough estimates are about 55 to 75% of customers' assets can be made whole based on the assets they have. But again, that's just an early estimate given the fact that you have a fraud here. We don't know exactly how deep it goes. We don't know exactly how many assets are left in Mr. Wassendorf's estate, or if there's other complicit parties that we could look to for additional recoveries.
Now, I received an email this morning from one of our partners and longtime listeners. He said that he thought he had really hedged himself well. He was a client of one of the largest, MF Global, and then also a client of one of the smallest, PFG. And he got bit on both ends. What can traders, what can investors do to protect themselves from this type of thing? And are there any red flags that we should be on the lookout for?
Problem is, it's really hard to do due diligence on fraud. Right. If someone decides that they're going to commit a crime,
mm-hmm.
it's a very hard thing to stop them. We as a society have really, in the last several years, devalued the deterrent effect, especially in the financial industry. I mean, it's just horrible that no one went to jail or was even indicted over all the fraud that occurred in 2008. Same thing here with MF Global. And, you know, if the people in charge aren't scared of the regulators and they aren't scared of going to jail, it's really hard to prevent fraud. In terms of red flags, if we want to take some hindsight here, you've got the fact that Corzine publicly said we're going to be, you know, Goldman 2 and turn ourselves into an investment bank and start taking principal risk with prop trading. I mean, that was all publicly disclosed. And, you know, put out there, But I think that the customers, both of MFG and of PFG, took a lot of comfort in the fact that in 200 years of commodity trading, no customer had ever lost a penny in a segregated account. And customers had put a lot of stock in those protections up until really this week. And the fact that those protections no longer seem safe is a horrible thing, not only for the futures industry, but really across the U.S. financial system. Because if say, in Corzine's case, if someone could take $1.6 billion out of customer accounts that are supposed to be far safer than a bank account, to cover risky trades, how do you say your 401k is safe? How do you say your IRA is safe? It's really hard to do that.
James, I have a question for you. This is David. You know, I always was under the impression, for maybe just bad reasons, maybe not clear, I wasn't maybe clear on it, but I was under the impression that there were protections of some kind, and you just mentioned some protections. I'm now pretty clear that there really are no protections. There's no insurance for these funds. There's nothing that stops people working for the company to go into segregated accounts and gamble with it or, you know, run off with it. As a matter of fact, it's just as unsafe as putting your money in, in a box somewhere and hoping that somebody doesn't pick it up, because there isn't any insurance that I'm aware of. I've heard of the SPIC, but what does that insurance really do for me?
Well,
I'm a customer, by the way, of MFG. I lost money with them as well. I'm not a client of yours, but I did lose. So.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
So SIPC insurance is currently limited only to customers of on the security side of the business. So MF Global was only covered there for about 300 securities accounts. Commodity accounts did not have that insurance. And for 200 years, the public policy said that you don't need that insurance because, as opposed to a bank or a broker where the house entities can fractionally reserve lend, and they could, say, take your bank deposit and then lend against it, you know, tenfold, commodity accounts, by law, have to have in excess of 100% of deposits in an account segregated at all times. And those are actually very, very strong protections. However, the problem we've seen here in the last 8 months is that those protections have not been upheld. So at MF Global, October 27th, 4 days before they filed bankruptcy, the CME, which was the regulator for MF Global, came in and said, MF Global, you're not allowed to wire any money out of the segregated account unless you have our approval. And they did it anyway. And they're not in jail.
I don't understand that either. I don't understand why. Where is John Corzine right now?
The last I heard, he's in the Hamptons.
Okay. You know, if you or I or anyone else ran a company where we took $10,000 from somebody, we would be either in jail or out on bail. Here's a guy that ran a company.
Assuming we don't donate $500,000 to Obama's reelection campaign.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Well, you know, you make a fine point there. But let's just say that we had done something like that, we would have the post bail, you know, all that stuff. There's been nothing that has happened to him except having to go in front of a congressional hearing and say that he doesn't know. And since then, things have been great. And is it your impression? I'm just curious what you think. What do you think is going to happen to him?
I think a lot depends on this election cycle. You know, we as an organization are completely bipartisan. I mean, I voted for Obama last time. John Rose's dad is a Republican congressman, and our third board member is a lifelong Democrat. I mean, we could care less about the partisan nature of this stuff. We just want to see some integrity restored to the financial system. And, you know, we've met with the Democratic leadership in D.C., and we've told them that this should really be something that you guys think about strategically as a campaign. I mean, Obama campaigned on bringing justice to Wall Street and, you know, cracking down on fraud and crime. And there's an ad put out by one of the PACs, I think it's called, like, Justice for Sale, where it outlines, you know, a lot of things Obama's done. And, you know, as much as, you know, as much as everybody wants to hate the PAGs, they're right. I mean, you got a situation where just because a guy's a big contributor to the Democratic Party, there is no serious investigation or prosecution of him being done. And, you know, part of that is where I think we're in election year. Part of it is that, you know, Eric Holder's already been held in contempt of Congress for Fast and the Furious. But, you know, we look how fast...
I saw that movie.
<That's joking. laughs> Go ahead. We look how fast, you know, the CFTC and FBI have sprung into action in PFG when it's a Republican donor. Who's the one committing the crime. And, you know, I can't help but think that there's some political reason for the difference in speed. I mean, granted, it's an easier case in PFG since you have a signed confession. You know, at least this guy had, you know, I don't know if you want to say an honor, but at least, you know, he tried to inflict some kind of punishment on him. I mean, Corzine is a complete sociopath. I mean, I've gotten up in his face in Congress, and I mean, you know, he stared me down with nothing but rage and contempt from me in his eyes. I mean, I didn't see a shred of remorse or, and you know, all Corzine cared about was his own ego. I mean, that's why, you know, he got $1.6 billion missing because he wanted to keep those trades on at all costs. He had 2,800 employees out of work because of him. And he's scum and needs to go to jail.
Yeah, he does. He does. Let me ask you these questions. Maybe you know the answers. Maybe you don't. And nobody may know the answers. If I had moved money around into different bank accounts, if I had a company and started and it had customer funds and I started moving that money around, it's all very traceable, especially as you get into larger dollar amounts. It's been quite some time, and the FBI and other people that know how to trace money and to walk through the banking system would certainly have, by now, had some idea what happened to this money. Forget that he says he doesn't know, John, but certainly the investigation would now know. And yet, as far as I know, and I haven't heard and read everything, but we don't know, do we, what happened to the money?
Yeah, we do.
Okay.
Trustee in the broker-dealer liquidation, James Giddens, published a 275-page report a little over a month ago, and he says specifically the money was not lost because they were investing in it under Rule 1.25. It wasn't lost due to some kind of operational error. The money went out the door to meet margin calls on the house trades, and that's theft, okay? Yeah, where the money is at J.P. Morgan, Bank of New York. Some of it went to the CME, and the CME is had reached a settlement with the trustee to return it, which Louis Free, who is acting as the trustee of the holding company case and is a shill for J.P. Morgan, has been trying to stall the release of that money to customers. But the trustee knows where the money is. He's given J.P. Morgan, I think they've got another 2 weeks or so, to return the money back, or... the trustee says it's going to file suit against J.P. Morgan.
Now, would that make John Corzine having told a lie in front of Congress because he knows then that it went into margin calls? What would have stopped him from saying this money went into margin calls?
I mean, I definitely believe that he lied in front of Congress. And in fact, I was
sitting behind. To what end? What's wrong with saying it went into margin call? We didn't run the business right, and these things were margin called.
Well, because then he's admitting that he violated the law.
So
these are customer segregated accounts that he used to meet margin calls for MF Global's proprietary positions.
I get it. So he was using customer funds to make margin call to fulfill margin call requirements for proprietary trading of MF Global.
Yeah,
they messed up, and
that's essentially theft.
No, of course. That's what it is. Okay, so we do know where the money is, we do know what happened to it, and we do know that he must have known that they took a huge sum of their money from segregated accounts and used it to fulfill margin calls in their own trading that had gone awry in their own proprietary trading programs.
No.
That's right. So, I can give you some more color on that if you want, but I mean, the facts are very clear that it was done intentionally.
Let's just differentiate here between margin call and margin requirements, right? This is Michael Woodley.
I mean, they had a margin call on their European sovereign debt positions after the firm's credit rating was downgraded. downgraded, and basically on one side they were trying to liquidate their short-term cash equivalents. They sold about $1.3 billion in commercial paper to Goldman, and J.P. Morgan dragged its feet releasing the proceeds of those trades. So, you know, the theory goes is that, on the other side they had a $200 million margin call in the MF Global UK unit in London, also to J.P. Morgan. And J.P. Morgan said that they wouldn't release the proceeds from the commercial paper transactions unless MF Global met the $200 million margin call. So what happened is, on October 28th, MF Global provided a falsified segregated funds report to their regulator, the CME, that said that they had exactly $200 million in excess firm capital held in the customer segregated account. And, you know, it's a couple ironies here is that the $200 million in excess happened to be the exact amount of the margin call. Yet on October 27th, they only had $100 million in excess. So this report that they, you know, supposedly, you know, said was good enough to send to the regulators assumed that they were actually growing their capital excess while a bank run was in progress. And that's just pretty much impossible, first of all. Second of all, during the course of that week, they adjusted the balance in their reported segregation account by $540 million with a manual override for which there was no supporting documentation whatsoever. I mean, us as a regulated entity, if we make an adjustment of like $20, we have to have supporting documentation for it. And they wired this $200 million in falsified, falsely reported excess to J.P. Morgan on the 28th. They did it without asking the CME's permission, and they did it at the same time that they were redirecting customer requests to get their funds back that were made for wire transfers to checks. So they were check-kiting, and
every rule on the book.
Customers. Yeah, and these guys aren't in jail. I don't.
Yeah,
understand.
That is funny. Remember the book?
That's great.
Do you remember what was the book a million years ago that was when we were all kids? You may be too young, James, but what was
Catch
the book?
Catch Me If You Can.
No, no. The guy that said, I can't think of the name of the title of the book, but it was a book of all the bank check kiting and everything else that you could do to make money. The Lazy Man Ways to Riches. Okay, and this is literally a booklet on everything illegal you can do. It's like these guys, it's like Corusine and his friends sat around smoking something, reading The Lazy Man's Ways to Riches, and they've done every one of the things in that book in this crime. And having said that, I just want to say, James, that we had a small amount of money in there as well, and we've got probably 85% of it back. And could you lend me $50 along with the supporting documentation? Would that be possible? No. Okay. Really.
Yeah, I mean, we laugh, but I mean, this is disgraceful. Like, this is
no, it's terrible.
Right?
It's terrible.
I mean, you know, so our country was founded on you know, the premise of protecting individual property rights. I mean, that was one of the most important, you know, tenets of our society. And we're in a stage now with when we've got all the technology to track this stuff,
yes,
where we know exactly what happened, and essentially you could donate $500,000 to a president's reelection campaign and then go party in the Hamptons after, you know, $1.6 billion was fraudulently removed from your company.
This sounds strangely like the Mark Ritchie story. Yeah, am I getting his name right? Or whatever the guy was.
Mark Rich. Yeah.
Mark Rich, yeah. Which is the President Clinton
pardoned
yeah. him after, you know, the whole thing. So it's good business to give money to presidential candidates that become president. That's a kind of a get out of jail card.
He's continued to bundle money for Obama after this has happened. So Obama actually returned $70,000 in direct contributions that Corzine gave him, but he's kept all the bundled money, as far as I know.
How do you sleep at night knowing all the stuff you know about this? Because it is so aggravating. And so, obviously, you're very passionate about it. What kind of drugs are you on when you go to bed?
Actually, I just fly so much and then spend so many hours working, I fall asleep.
Okay.
My head is the pillow, but...
All right. Okay, that's a good answer. Just checking.
James,
James, James, it's Bert from Daniels Trading.
Hey, Bert.
Hey, how are you? Hey, do you think, don't you think the CFTC has to take some responsibility? I mean, what's your position on that? I mean, they were supposed to be there to do the checks and balances. Didn't they fail on their end?
It's too early to tell if they have any liability here. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, my initial reaction is, you know, you let this thing go on for years. You don't pick up the phone once to call the banks. I mean, they did a spot audit back in January where they checked something like 75 different FCMs in conjunction with the NFA. And the release from that spot audit says, everything's fine, but by the way, we didn't actually verify the balances with the depositors. And I mean, you know, I got to say, like, heads need to roll at the CFTC. I mean, Gensler is a joke, and you know, I guess I say that at great personal peril since I'm regulated by the CFTC, but I mean, the agency's a disgrace under him.
I'm with you. You know, right now, in the end, what if you're a PFG client, what should they do? I mean, what should be their first order of business, you think?
You know, I think the first order is probably go to our website, commoditycustomercoalition.org, and in the top right-hand corner, they could sign up to be a part of our newsletter. You know, right now, there's still a lot of facts that have to come out to see how this case is going to play out. But, I, you know, I filed my my pro hoc vice for admittance into the bankruptcy bar for this case today. So, I mean, I will be representing individuals pro bono in the case and doing whatever I can to help get their money back. And, you know, us as an organization, I think, do a pretty good job of disseminating very reliable information. And that's the best way to keep informed.
Okay.
Well, I have to tell you, if myself or on behalf of people forget our situation, because we had a very small amount there, but I would feel very comfortable from what you've said. You sound like somebody that I would want on my side going after this guy, because and collecting the money, not even going after the guy, but getting the money back for investors, which would go a long way to at least in my particular case helping me believe that it's okay to have a sizable amount of money in a brokerage, which, to be honest with you right now, I'm not comfortable with. And obviously, I have good reason to not be. I don't want to frighten people, but it has frightened me that something like this can happen, and you really don't know if there's going to be a person like you out there that's going to help get the money back. You don't know if the government's just going to say, well, you know, because this administration has a view, you know, sort of looks badly upon people who are trying to get ahead, or people who are successful, that sort of thing. And I almost could very comfortably say to myself, well, they're not going to be helping me. The government's not going to come in and help me get that money back because it wasn't insured, and I'm screwed. You know, but there's people like you out there that are, you know, doing all the things, the gumshoe effort, all the way up to taking the getting the money back, which is very satisfying to hear. It would make me feel good if I was one of the people out there being on your list of people that you're fighting for.
Thank you. But yeah, I got to tell you, I mean, it's tough. I mean, we have a handful of volunteers, and I mean, we just went through the equivalent of like a white collar war, which isn't even done yet with MF Global, and you know, this is the last thing you know, we were either looking or hoping to happen.
What were you doing right before this happened? What were you doing with your life before this happened?
Opening a New York office and launching a securities trading arm of the firm. So, I mean, not like I was just sitting idle on the beach, you know.
I wasn't implying that, but I was just curious what you were doing as this came about, because you had something you were doing with your life, and this has obviously become the main focus and requires enormous research, and, you know, this has to be very tiring.
The name of your company, James, is Typhoon Capital, is that correct?
Typhoon Capital, yeah.
Typhoon.
1-0.
That's how I met James. He came into the office one day, and I was introducing some business to him and into his fund, because he does run a successful CTA. He's got some good product with good returns, and that's how we kind of got together, along with some other things. And yeah, if people are interested on the CPA side and the managed product side, certainly one to look at in his products. So
past performance is not necessarily indicative of future
returns. I forgot.
I am a lawyer. I want to add to this, James. You may not look as young as you look in this picture by the time you meet some of these people, because this stuff can age you.
Yeah, I mean, I
you look pretty good in this picture, James. You know, you might want to put that one on the wall somewhere. Just remember how when I look like this, honey?
Before and after. Yeah, no, it's been a long year, man. The hair is graying.
Okay, well, it's a good picture, though.
Now, James, on the surface, it looks like these two issues are very different, MF Global versus PFG. I mean, I was astounded by the high-tech nature of the PFG scheme, and that was to get in the car, drive across the state line, and open a post office box?
Yeah.
I mean, there has to be more to it than that, right? Or is there?
I mean, the NFA told me that this box had apparently been the official address on file for U.S. Bank for 10-some years, and that somehow that Russ got control of it. I don't know if that's still their position. They gave me that a couple days ago. But, I mean, it's...
Well, I've got this fake statement up on the screen right here. There's the P.O. box, the amount, $218 million, that number written in by hand and signed by, who is this document signed by? Do you know? Offhand.
You know, I only have the first page of the scan, so if you...
Okay, the second page over here is an actual bank statement.
I've got the bank statement where it's got $218 million,
right.
You know, typed on it. I don't have the confirmation one.
But what we're to understand is that this document is fake, correct?
I believe so, yeah.
This is not an actual statement generated by U.S. Bank, but something done on a computer with Photoshop or whatever.
I don't know exactly how it was generated.
Okay.
I mean, there was, you know, so the NFA guys at least implied that perhaps it was done at U.S. Bank, but I don't know.
Oh, really?
It's speculation at this point.
Okay.
But the guys who I talked to see the original document say it looks pretty perfect.
It does.
Better than a birth certificate we're all familiar with.
Oh, I'm not going there.
Yeah, I don't want to go there either.
Now, a couple questions from the studio audience. Bruce wanted me to ask you about a couple of names. I'm not familiar with these names. He said, please ask James about Edith O'Brien and Christine Sierwinski.
Yeah, so Edith was the assistant treasurer at MF Global, who was kind of in the heart of the whole, you know, final days, and basically at the CFO's request, which Sierwinski was one of the CFOs. There were two different CEOs, her and Henry Steenkamp.
Okay.
And Sierwinski was actually in the process of stepping down from MF Global and was on a ballroom dancing retreat the week the bankruptcy happened. You can't make this stuff up. But,
you can't make this stuff up.
But Edith is basically who I think Corzine tried to make as a fall girl in this whole thing. She's, you know, been in the business 20 plus years, has a, you know, excellent reputation, and you know, it's our position as an organization that Edith should be given immunity by the DOJ, as I have personal knowledge that she has some pretty significant evidence against the C-suite over there.
So, Edith, you recommend immunity. What about Sierwinski?
You know, Sierwinski, I'm not sure exactly how involved she was in this. Like, she was literally on her way out the door. You know, I from what I've seen, I think that Corzine and Henry Steenkamp, the other CFO, should be, if I was running the criminal investigation, that's who I'd be looking at.
Now, based on one of the interviews I saw with you, or an article I read, I think you've got a bone to pick here with J.P. Morgan as well, correct?
Yeah, so J.P. Morgan is the bank that was the very involved in this. They were the largest lender to MF Global. They were the custodian of a lot of the customer funds. They were the clearing and settling agent for MF Global's proprietary trading. They were able to kind of game the UK bankruptcy process to buy the sovereign debt positions out of bankruptcy with essentially no oversight, and then flip them to Soros almost immediately for about a six handle profit on that. They were also able to buy MF Global's London Metals Exchange stock out of the UK bankruptcy, which LMAE is in the process of being sold, for which JP Morgan will get a huge profit on that stock. But anyway, they're the ones who received several hundred million dollars in customer funds for payment of margin calls. And when I started voicing all the facts about JPM in the media, they actually took the stance of closing all of my personal hedge fund, my personal bank accounts, my hedge fund bank account, the CCC's bank account. They closed my personal credit card, and they did so in very questionable fashion, and I'm actually have an attorney preparing some litigation against them for their various bullying techniques.
Wow. So they really came after you personally over this?
Yeah, from the executive offices, all these notices came out.
Hmm.
So
there's more to
class acts over there. But you know,
no, I'm telling you, I was going to invite you to lunch, but I don't want to be seen with you. I'm not sure that would be good for me.
That might be safe, but you know, I do take at least a little comfort of the fact that back in March I wrote an open letter to Jamie Dimon that you could look at on Zero Hedge, you know, kind of relating my background in Greek classics and hubris to the man, and you know, his unbridled arrogance, and mm-hmm. I predicted that I don't know when, but something bad is going to happen to J.P. Morgan, and here we have the whale trade, as we heard about it full glory in today's conference call. So couldn't happen mm-hmm. to a nicer guy, Jamie.
Well, I'll tell you something. This is such an interesting story that just to finish off the final graying of your hair, you could write a book at the end of all this. And I'm sure you would have quite a number of readers that would want to know all these details and how it all played out, because this is really crime at the highest levels. On some level, it's way up there.
It really is, and it's just it makes our country look so bad that this guy could be partying in the Hamptons after a $1.6 billion fraud. I mean, it's an utter disgrace, and really all Americans should be ashamed that the government that we've elected is not doing more to protect us. Because let's remember, I mean, MF Global's customers were a lot of farmers, ranchers, Coca-Cola, ConocoPhillips, I mean, major American corporations, retirees, mm-hmm. and all these people had money just outright stolen from them to cover a sociopath's incredibly risky trades. And nothing is being done about it. And it's a travesty.
Well, you've done a great job of explaining. I, for one, much, much clearer now understand what happened from your explanation, and I really appreciate that.
At this point, James, if a person was a client at PFG Best, is there any action they should be taking? Is it a wait-and-see approach? What should people
do? Right now, they should just sign up for our newsletter on commoditycustomercoalition.org. And you know, we've got all the lawyers moving, and you know, we'll be, our co-founder John Rowe is going to be speaking or testifying before the Senate Banking Committee about it in a couple weeks. You know, we're on this. We're doing whatever we can, you know, for customers. But you know, there's nothing that they could individually do on their own right now.
So at your website, commoditycustomercoalition.org. Where do folks sign up for the newsletter?
It's in the top right-hand corner.
under resources.
Let me pull it up.
Or customer action.
It's right under the search box that says receive CCC updates. And you could just click a link, sign up to receive
CCC updates.
Okay. And they just put in their email and hit subscribe, and they'll be on the list.
Gotcha. Okay, guys. All right. As this progresses, we'd like to invite you to come back and talk with us again and keep us kind of up to speed on this and up to date. Does David, Bert, anyone else have any additional questions for James?
I'm impressed with how knowledgeable he is, and if something really bad happens, I'll bail you out. I'll get you out, and you can continue going if something really weird happens to you along the way. Okay.
Well, you know, the running joke in my family is, you know, if I slip in the shower or get hit by a bus or something, it was J.P. Morgan's fault. So.
Okay, well, I'll make a note of that right here.
Stay away from any grassy knolls, okay?
Yeah. No, but you are the guy to do this. I mean, I can tell in your tone and in your the detail that you are behind this. You're scary. You know,
yeah.
I mean,
thank you. I guess.
Yeah, this is going to be. If I was on the wrong side of the law, I would not want you chasing me. So that means that's a good thing for the people like myself and others that have been through this with them. So.
And the next time we have you on the show, James, perhaps we can talk a little bit about J.P. Morgan's manipulation of the silver market.
You know, that's something I've heard a whole ton about, but, you know, I don't have enough evidence there to speak on that on record. But, you know, feel free to you know, send me anything you got, because it's a very interesting, you know, story, but it's hard for me to kind of know definitively what the reality is there.
We'll all sleep better knowing you're on the case.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming on the show today, folks. Go visit James at his site.
Thank you again, Jim.
That is commoditycustomercoalition.org. This guy's all over the net, CNBC, Fortune, wherever you turn, you're going to see James. You heard him here on the show. If you have any questions, feel free to email them into the program. I'll pass them along to James, and next week I'll provide answers with you as James is able to email them over to me. And again, an open invitation, as soon as you have more information, to come back on the show and share with us again.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, James.
Remember this, there is no greater return on investment than to see a human life changed and given hope. As always, pray hard and trade safe. Any financial information discussed on this show is simply the opinion of our host, Dwayne Reeves, his co-hosts, and guests. To learn more about trading e-mini futures or to take a one-week free trial in our live trading room, call 1-866-928-3310. 866-928-3310. Information discussed on this radio program should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Always do your own due diligence and consult with a licensed securities broker or financial planner before making any investment decision.